Live from Burbank, California, where yesterday I had a meeting to have a meeting. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, Boffo B.O. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Of course, you need machines, pain sponges. All of us under one big umbrella, because it might rain. It might rain. The nuclear rain might come down. My dad's been writing me emails now. He's getting very political all of a sudden. My father's writing me emails about the inconvenient truth and how great it is and whether Gore should run again. And he's asking me about nuances of policy. And this is how my dad, he's just applying himself. This is a new thing. Before he was all apocalyptic about everything. Then he got kind of Jewy for a while. But now he wants to bond with me. So now it's all politics with my old man on the email.
So your dad's bonding with you, rebonding?
He's trying to rebond. I try to keep a healthy distance because my father has absolutely no boundaries whatsoever, and he has emotional and psychological problems, which means if I'm not careful and I go ahead and take the bait of the rebonding, that then I will be enmeshed, and it's only a matter of time before he comes crashing down, and I don't want to be too close to that. You know what I mean? You like a little distance from that to say, yeah, Dad, okay, wish I could help you out, but I got to go because my cat needs to come in. Something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
But someday you may never have that chance again to get that weird with your dad.
No, I don't want that chance again. My relationship with him has been going pretty well, and I have no problem. I'm actually pretty excited that he's gotten sort of political, because this was a guy that watched Fox News and really could not differentiate between bias and not bias. And I think a lot of people have that problem, unfortunately. He would watch O'Reilly. He would watch the news on Fox News and think, like, this is the news. It looks like the news. That guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. This must be what it is. That there was no real barometer to determine bias on his part, and he thought he was getting the whole scoop. And he has a propensity towards being somewhat of a bully, my father, and that kind of talk appeals to him. And what happens now is that after me having this job and me talking to him about the other side of politics, like he was quick to write to me about seeing Gore's film and how it seemed like a campaign film and how he thinks he'd be a pretty good candidate. And I said, yeah, I think it is a test balloon to determine whether or not he will run. And then he, of course, went back to, like, well, if Gore was president, you think 9/11 would have happened? Do you think we would have Iraq happened? We got to deal with these vermin over there somehow. So then you get that language again where it's sort of like, there's still this vermin out there that needs to be dealt with, and these guys are dealing with it. And I told him to go research what's going on in Afghanistan, to go have a look at what's really going on in Iraq, and whether or not this retaliation model or this justified war really worked. And perhaps he will, because the Afghanistan thing blows me away. It blows me away where we're at with Afghanistan and that these people are trying to justify the war in Iraq. Afghanistan, southern Afghanistan, is a disaster. It's a disaster, and the government in Afghanistan is subcontracting militias that are warlord militias. These are drug lord militias that they have to subcontract to help fight the Taliban.
Oh, man, I thought we were doing okay there.
No. Not only is it not okay, it's returning back to what it was. The drug industry is incredibly it's lucrative right now. Tons and tons of opiates are coming out of there, of opium. And the South is being once again dominated and terrorized by the Taliban. It's the Taliban. The Taliban is walking around putting notes on people's houses saying, if you don't come with us, we're going to kill you. They're killing people in the streets. They're making examples of killing people in the streets. They're trying to convert people to their cause by, you know, literally holding the heads of their friends in their faces saying, come with us. That, you know, the United States are the enemies. The allied forces are the enemies. And it is what it used to be. It's a weird combination of the Taliban and drug warlords who run the country. And they have a certain agreement or not, but those are the two entities. The allied forces are not outnumbered, but they're not having a successful time there. And Karzai says that the Bush administration has to reassess its policy. Now, this was the war to be won. This was the war that most people supported. This was the war that was fought because the terrorists organized in Afghanistan. That's where the headquarters were. That was terrorist central. That's where bin Laden was. That's where all the training was done. And now that place is returning back to what it was. And, of course, the talk is about Iraq. And I watched Russ Feingold on Meet the Press. And man, that guy is the real deal. He's impressive. He's got nothing to hide. He's been very careful about his record in the Senate. He speaks his mind. He votes his heart. And Tim Russert, I don't know what to make of that guy. I don't know. Maybe I can't detect bias either, but he seems to be, you know, sincerely biased to the right wing, the way he made Feingold jump through hoops. Literally made him jump through hoops. He's like, this is something you said, taken out of context 3 years ago. How do you address that? And Feingold goes, basically, every time the Russert did that, Feingold said, yes, you're taking that out of context, and I said that 3 years ago, but I stand by it. But he did it several times, trying to corner Feingold into some sort of misspeak. And Feingold defended his proposal for censure. He defended his stance on the war. He was very articulate, and I wish to hell that guy could be president. I wished it because this is a guy, he believes, he says, I got into politics to protect the Constitution. He believes in the system of government here. And then he got Murtha down there at a small town hall meeting in Florida, in Miami, Florida, basically saying, he's saying, look, we don't want permanent bases in Iraq. We want as many Americans out of there as possible. And then he got General Casey making these statements about possible withdrawal that he could. This is the scary thing. What's happening is the Democrats, as opposed to not being on the same page, even though Hillary Clinton is trying to triangulate the Democrats now, literally, there's some Democrats that say everybody out by 2007. There's some that say we don't want to put a deadline on it, but let's make sure they start coming out. And Hillary gets up and says, well, we're coming to an agreement. Who the hell died and left her in charge, number one? And that's just the way she does things. But the bottom line is that with Casey, the general on the ground, saying that we could possibly by 2007 pull about 70,000 or 7,000 guys out of there and really start to peel it down to almost nothing except for helicopters and special forces. He's saying that. The White House is saying, oh, we're not going to buy that quite yet. We're not behind that because it really matters as to whether or not the Iraqi government can handle itself. And then you have the Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki saying that we're putting together a program here that'll bring people together and bring some of the lesser insurgents under the fold through amnesty, which I think is crazy. I tend to agree with Sam Cedar in terms of saying, you know, if you start talking about amnesty and there's still guys on the ground, you're basically giving people a free ticket to shoot Americans and give them the idea that they might get off the hook. But there's so many mixed messages coming. What frightens me is that by the time the midterms come along, if they go with what General Casey's saying, which I think is the right thing to do, the Democrats will have absolutely no position on Iraq because it will be the same as the Republicans. And then it'll be really interesting to see what happens to those elections. On the show today, we've got Congressman George Miller of California's 7th District. He is going to be talking to us about the minimum wage. He is the senior Democrat on the Committee on Education and the Workforce. We've got author Justin Frank in just a second, the writer, the author of Bush on the Couch, where he psychoanalyzed Bush. That book came out about 2 years ago. Let's see if he's made any progress or he's gotten worse, his pathology, and what the prognosis is. It's out in paperback now. Christopher Noxon, author of Rejuvenile, Kickball, Cartoons, Cupcakes, and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up, is going to talk to about something that I can't stand. That's grown men on scooters, or grown men with their baseball hats turned backwards, or anybody who has a lunchbox and they're over 30. We'll be back.
And now he's donated most of his vast debt to the Gates Foundation, Mark Maron.
All right, here we go. Dr. Justin A. Frank is a respected Washington, D.C.-based psychoanalyst and a professor of psychiatry. He does classic Freudian analysis, which, whether you believe in it or not, always yields interesting and disturbing symbolic results and explanations for behavior. Dr. Frank's unwitting patient is George W. Bush. In his book, Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, which is now out in paperback, he psychoanalyzes the president, and the prognosis is more than disturbing. Welcome to the show, Dr. Frank.
Thank you.
Since the book originally came out 2 years ago, you've had a couple of years now to further observe your patient. Has he made any progress?
No, he's not, unfortunately. In fact, I think as his defenses against his own anxieties start to break down around him, he becomes more essentially who he is, which is very closed off to the world, really angry. He does fight back a lot when he's feeling attacked, which is, of course, all the time.
So you feel like he's gotten sicker?
I think that as his defenses get broken down, you can see the sickness more clearly. I think he's as sick as he always was.
Well, let's talk about some of
the difference is that people are now being able to pay attention and notice it.
Now, let's talk about your original diagnosis of what he is. What are his essential pathology?
Oh, my God. I wrote a book about it.
I know.
Pathology includes everything from ADHD to dyslexia to serious anxiety to alcoholism untreated to sadism to omnipotence.
But let's talk. What about the? Okay, so let's stick with omnipotence and
okay.
And also let's before we do that, let's talk about the ADHD. I mean, some people have grown to believe that all that stuff, that behavior that looks like attention deficit disorder. Is actually intentional, that it's a sham, that he acts distracted and detached because that's his public persona when he wants to wiggle out of things. But you still contend that it's a sickness.
There's too much evidence that that's not the case. I mean, if you look at pictures of him when he was governor and watch him when he's off, you know, when he's not giving a speech, but watch him when he's officially off camera, he's twitching around, not paying attention, tapping people, very agitated and unable to sit still.
Well, I don't want to make him see. My fear is I don't want to make him a sympathetic character because he has these problems in my mind.
Well, I you know, that's the hardest thing as a psychoanalyst.
Uh-huh.
I actually am sympathetic to his humanity. In fact, some people who are much more strident critics of him than I am even, although that's hard to believe, are really upset that were upset even when the book came out that it was much more sympathetic to him, because we're all more human than otherwise. He is not fit for the job. He should not be president. He is not competent to do the job. There is no question about that. He does have an omnipotent core, untreated, pathological state. And
he's a narcissist, right?
He is very narcissistic, yes. He's very grandiose.
And because of that,
lots of presidents are narcissists.
You sort of have to be.
You have to be run for office.
Right, you have to be. But the one problem with narcissism, if I'm not mistaken, is that you have a pathological lack of conscience, an inability to be empathetic.
Yes.
And that can be certainly criticized, and that I'm not even sure that's treatable. I mean, narcissism isn't really treatable, is it?
Well, this kind of narcissism is not treatable because it's also laced with a lot of cruelty.
Okay, now in talking about the way I figure, when you talk about his lack of recovery around his alcoholism and his addiction, and that he possibly surrounded himself by enablers, as you say in your book, I think that he is severely handicapped and he's surrounded by handlers. And his one crime is that he's incapable of being honest, and it's almost like he's a Manchurian candidate. I think that people have that he's a puppet to some very evil people, and his complicity makes him evil.
I think that's part of it, but I think that one of the problems that people on the left have in seeing him as a puppet is that that's another way we even have of helping him evade responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a puppet, you're not responsible, and that fits in with his entire MO, which is to never be responsible for anything.
So he has to be held accountable, and because of
he has to be held accountable.
Yeah, that despite whatever psychological ailments he might have, he has to be held accountable. Now, in your experience with dealing with patients like this, if they are forced to be held accountable, how do they react?
Well, they get enraged at the person who's holding them accountable. That's why he has such trouble when people ask him direct questions in press conferences. That's why Helen Thomas was frozen out for several years. When anybody confronts him directly, it makes him enraged. What was so striking about him last week at the press conference after he got back from Baghdad was how quickly the rest of the Republicans jumped on the bandwagon and saw him as mounting a comeback, as it were. And what I was struck by was when he was on script, he was very forceful and clear, and I watched that whole conference, and I was quite impressed. But then as soon as he was off script, I felt that he was out of control and almost manic, and that furthermore, he was not aware at some, and I don't know how to talk about this psychologically, even though I'm an expert in psychoanalysis, it's like he's not aware that he's president. He's not aware of the gravity of his position. So he gets off in joking like Roger, Roger, or doing this thing with the guy with the dark glasses and the blind guy, or making these off-the-cuff kind of jokes like he's in a fraternity house. And they're very childish, and people understand that about him, and that's part of his charm, the boyishness. But it's striking how I actually think in context there's something seriously wrong, because I don't think he gets the fact that he's president, that he has this awesome responsibility.
I think that's true. I've noticed that about him as well, that you know he certainly doesn't have the gravitas to hold the office.
No.
And then on top of that, you know, he goes off on these digressions that he tries to make cute by laughing at himself or stumbling over something, or actually making sort of bullyish type of jokes. But it seems to me that like he's a guy that like if left in a room is just going to sit and fidget and not know what the hell to think, and somebody comes in and puts his tie on for him and walks him out and tells him to say these things.
Right.
And I think that the most frightening thing is that there are times where people, I wonder really when he's not being told what to do, you know, your assumption is that he's still a pretty, you know, sadistic, classist, non-empathetic, insecure person.
Exactly. You've taken all the right words. That's exactly what I think.
And the insecurity issue, that unfortunately, I think, is what makes him appealing to whoever the hell still likes him, whatever the 30%, the ones that aren't religious wackos, but the ones that like his stubbornness and his ignorance, and they consider that to be strength, they come from the same place he does. They've been, they're insecure, and they see strength in being controlling and bullying.
I think that's right. I think the other thing that part of the charm of it, even though he's the person who's in charge of the country and the lawmaker and the lawgiver, if you will,
yeah,
he is actually a person who hates law and is defiant against authority. So when he says, I don't need a permission slip from the UN, he said that a few years ago, that was so appealing to so many people.
Well, thanks.
It is appealing to everybody who ever had a father.
That's right.
All of us.
That's right. Well, thanks for your time, Dr. Frank. I appreciate you being here.
Okay.
You take care.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
We'll be back.
Now his close circle of friends is shrinking. Mark Maron.
Oh, it can't shrink any more than it already has, than it already is. I keep a very small close circle, Jim.
It's getting smaller, you know, modern times.
What do you say, my wife's leaving me? What do you know?
She's not going to leave it, but she's only going to communicate you via some sort of electronic device.
It's so much better that way. Yeah, you know, I have made more amends, more apologies, more makeup calls on the phone. Literally, I think I used to get in, if we got into a fight, I would leave the house. I would call her and talk to her. Like I'm better at making up on the phone than I am in person.
And you know, the CIA has a copy of every one of those apologies.
They can have them. They look, my NSA guy, he can have all of them. He can have all those. And I'll be honest with you, the anger thing has gotten much better. And what Dr. Frank was talking about, by the way, Bush on the Couch, if you don't have the book, it's a great read. Like he said, he might make him more of a person than you're willing to want to let in, the president. But he's a bright guy, Justin Frank. And all the daddy stuff that he was just getting into towards the end, that prolonged Oedipal conflict, that struggle, that contempt, that the stubbornness that comes from resenting your father your entire life and the decisions you make in relation to that, I think relate to a lot of people. And I think what he was saying towards the end of that interview is true, that the type of people that like what George Bush is, they define their character by their reactions to their dominating fathers or their absent fathers.
And that is who they are. They are incapable of engaging in an inner dialogue that would allow empathy or a more open-mindedness.
You know that old Peter Falk movie from the early 70s with where Ben Gazzara had one point in the scene where he's real drunk and he's trying to push himself back into the womb of a fat lady?
What, is that a Cassavetes film? Was
yeah.
it Death of a Chinese Bookie? Or which?
I think it was Husbands or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's trying to, you know, getting real drunk, pushing himself back into the womb of this real huge woman.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just kind of, and I may be off base here, but I see the same thing having happened a number of times between George and Barbara.
Yeah, I think he probably does it whenever he sees her. He tries to get back in there.
I know I would.
And you know what's sad is that I hear that you can.
Yeah. Well,
I hear that at family gatherings, most of the Bush family gets back into Barbara's womb.
The Saudis have been there.
Sure.
You know it.
Yeah, Prince Bandar has been up in there. But a lot of times that's where they serve the buffet. Like if they're at Kenny Bumpport, the entire Bush clan will go, come on, it's time to get into Grammy's Yanni. And everybody just, the flaps open, and everybody, the entire Bush family, just climbs right up into Barbara's vagina, and that's where they serve the food.
The buffet. That explains why Osama's survived so long up there.
Yeah, and a lot of boating is done up there, too, apparently.
Boating?
A lot of boating, and you know, a lot of those fishing pictures are all taken inside Barbara's vagina. And a lot of people don't realize this. You know, when, what's that thing, George Bush was on, the Segway?
Segway, yeah.
Yeah, when he fell down and hurt himself on that Segway, that was inside his mother's vagina. And many people don't realize this, but this is the world that these people come from. They all come from that, and they all re-enter that. And that's they find a lot of their strength in there. Many members of the Skull and Bones Club have weekly meetings inside of Barbara Bush's vagina.
It's a huge place. It's a national treasure. I hear Teddy Roosevelt declared it a national treasure.
No
many
kidding.
Years ago, yes.
Teddy Roosevelt did.
Yes.
That's why I heard
the great
that,
conservationist.
I don't know if you heard this, and maybe I didn't get the press right. Maybe this is a fringe thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard they were thinking about actually putting a wing of the Smithsonian in Barbara Bush's vagina. And I don't know if they vote on that kind of stuff or if they just do that, if that's something that needs to be legislated.
They can vote on it, but they got to have a lot of ventilation. That's my argument.
But that also means that they'll have to sell tickets and anybody could just go in there, which I think goes against what the family's really about.
The Spirit of St. Louis could fit in there.
Yeah, it's been in there. I think they're thinking about moving that over there.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm not sure how far we can go with this, but I hear that there's no global warming in Barbara Bush's vagina. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't. Really?
Yeah, that if you lived there, that the chances of the race go ahead existing beyond when they think global warming will happen is that's apparently the people that are on the inside.
Right.
That, and I mean that both figuratively and literally, will be the only people that survive. So anybody who can fit in or is able to get into Barbara Bush's vagina are really the people that are going to be in charge of the future.
I went to the Natural History Museum a few weekends ago here in Los Angeles. Mm. You know what exhibit I saw?
What?
The bog people. You know where they found them?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Bush's vagina. No? The bog.
Yes.
In Ireland?
The bog people, you know, the peat bogs everywhere, all around.
I'd like to go see that. Was it creepy?
Oh, it was great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did they have, like, a mummified bog people?
They had the actual bog people.
And they're very small, aren't they?
They're very small because they kind of shrunk a little, but they have the original facial things and the hair.
I like that stuff.
One girl with a was strangled.
And these are people that didn't realize they were going to necessarily die, right?
Or even necessarily walk into
into that
Bush's
mess.
Vagina.
Right. And here they are thinking, like, you know, what good am I? You know, really, what does life mean? What is immortality? And you learned a little something about the bog because of their mummified corpses. So we can only hope to have that kind of longevity after we die.
I would love to have myself mummified in that manner.
In the bog?
And then brought back into a museum somewhere.
Well, maybe you should get in touch with the Bush family and see if that option's available to you. Just tell them who you are. I'm Jim Earle, and I want in.
Smuggle myself in one of the buffets.
Yeah, you can maybe work at the buffet, just act as an employee.
That's right.
You got some poetry there? Is it time for Jim Earle's Poetry Corner?
Yeah, I have a poetry that I wrote in the transition before coming to this job here, working your radio show.
Uh-huh.
Right after Air America, I worked at Office Depot.
You did?
For
okay.
A few weeks. And I wrote this poem in dedication that's called Office Depot Customer Feedback Letters.
Mm.
Dear F-hole, If you so much as go near or even look at my son again, I'll hunt you down like an animal and cut off your balls. P.S. Thanks for helping me select the right workstation for my computer system. You'd be surprised how many times I've been led astray by some unknowledgeable salesman who doesn't know his third-party software from an IBM networking protocol. Now I can save my HyperCard stacks as standalone applications and distribute them royalty-free. Kudos to Office Depot. You really are my one-stop office store. Signed, Ted. Dear Monster, last night my wife broke down in tears and told me you fondled her breast while threatening her with a club. Your kind makes me sick, preying on the weak and defenseless. May God have mercy on your wicked soul. Pray to your maker, you perverted beast, for the time will come when I wrap my intestines around your neck like a garden hose and piss on your face. P.S. Thanks for steering my wife to the part of the store that really represents value pricing. Having looked everywhere, and I mean everywhere, for inexpensive bulk memo pads, she was just out at the end of her rope. But with one look in the Post-it notes bin, she knew Office Depot hadn't let her down. With prices like $18.99 for 10 pads of 50 sheets each, it's not hard to guess why this week is Memo Mania Week. Signed, the man who's going to kill you. Dear Sicko.
Yeah.
Having raised a family and been happily married for over 30 years now, I can with full confidence state that your behavior is indicative of a dementia so foul, so disturbing, so bestial, that even the very demons of Hades would turn away in shame. Good God, man, have you no soul? At what point did the light of decency within you die, taking with it your last warm feelings for humanity? Soon this world will relieve itself from the wretched burden of putrefaction that is your life, and your last breath will be my rebirth. However,
yeah,
your suggestion that I use Southworth ivory bond paper for all my letterheads, deeds, and presentations was right on. Now I know what you meant when you said, use a paper people will remember that looks and feels valuable, just like you. Mucho thanks for going out of your way to help with my media needs. Signed, the Crimson Banner of Righteousness.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. Earl, as pursuant to Penal Code CP951A, a warrant has been issued for your arrest. You are ordered by the California Municipal Code to surrender immediately or face more serious charges. Failure to appear before the above assigned date will result in automatic rejection of bail. Also, thanks for suggesting the scented colored envelopes. Nice touch. Sergeant McNulty. Thank you.
Awesome. Great stuff. Really great stuff.
Yeah, I have a fun time there at the Office Depot.
Used to do poetry slam, man. I know a comic that got into poetry slam. Wow, that music came right up. See, the music switched. It means that someone's saying, get on with it. We've got Congressman George Miller, senior Democrat on the Committee on Education and the Workforce, up next. Hang out.
Now he burned down his house because of bad test scores. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. As many of you know, for the first time since 1996, the Congress could vote to raise the minimum wage. Republicans refused to raise the wage while they meanwhile gave themselves a raise. That's the ninth raise in the 9 years that they haven't raised the minimum wage. And they just gave away up to $1 trillion to the wealthiest people in this country with their rolling back the estate tax. To talk about this and other issues is Congressman George Miller of California's 7th District. He is the senior Democrat on the Committee on Education and the Workforce. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Congressman Miller.
Thanks, Mark. How are you?
Good. I'm well. I guess my first question is, how can the Republicans live with themselves not raising the working wage?
It's hard to understand when you recognize that there's 7 to 8 million people who are working at a wage that now really is a poverty wage. It's not a minimum wage. It was originally designed to keep you out of poverty, but if you work at it today, a family of two, you're into the poverty line. A family of three or four is just in serious trouble.
And they keep spinning it, saying that they keep saying the Republicans say that the minimum wage increase would only affect teenagers, which is a lie.
I mean, there's a very high percentage of people that the primary breadwinner in the household is on minimum wage, right?
That's exactly the case. You know, 3/4 of them are over the age of 20, and about 60% are women, and they contribute over half of their family's income, no matter what their situation is. So it tells you the kinds of households that are being impacted. They want to keep making this out as an issue that this is about a summer job for a teenager. It's gone way beyond that at this point. It's really about a huge disparity in American society that cruelly, cruelly impacts these families. Because these people go to work every day, and at the end of the year, they just end up poor.
And some of them have two jobs, and most of them don't have health coverage at those jobs. And all of this is a result of the repercussions of the horrendous legislation that this Senate and House has been doing.
That's it, and we were just over in the committee today testifying, trying to make them put it on the floor for a vote. I think there's a bipartisan coalition that will vote to increase the minimum wage over the next 3 years to $7.25 an hour. I think we will get some Republican votes for that, but they're absolutely insistent that they're not going to do this, and we've now had two votes in committee to try and get it to the floor, and They block it, but as you pointed out, they found time to give 7,000 families $1 trillion in estate tax cuts.
And those tax cuts, that's a done deal?
Well, I think it's going to be a done deal. It passed in the House, and it's on its way to the Senate, and there's some concern that it will not be able to be stopped in the Senate, and it'll probably become law. That's $1 trillion that nobody's paying for, that's a loss to the government on top of $1 trillion war that nobody's paying for and is a loss to the government, among other things. And all the other spending that these guys have run up to an $8 trillion debt.
Well, let me ask you a question, Congressman George Miller. Is how do they defend this act? I mean, let's address that first. I mean, what are they saying is their argument for not raising the working wage?
They really have no argument. They fall back that this somehow it will cost these very same people the jobs. But there's more and more economic studies saying that's not the case. In fact, what we see in those states that have raised the minimum wage above the federal wage, the economy seemed to be growing a little bit faster, and job creation is a little bit higher than in the states where you don't have an increase in the minimum wage, probably because you're putting more money into those communities so people are able to spend money, which then businesses and others have to supply jobs to meet that demand. And so what they're talking about in terms of the minimum wage was what people were thinking in the 1950s and the 60s, and it's just been disproven now time and again as some states have raised the minimum wage. Unfortunately, as you pointed out, we haven't raised it for 9 years.
What also baffles me is how can this country be still seemingly polarized, whereas you have all these working people that you would think would be a tremendous issue for the Democrats to run on coming up on November to fix Congress so it's working properly, that why we don't hear more about this and why people are more outraged and their representatives aren't talking about it more.
Well, in many communities, you know, people working at the minimum wage are almost invisible. It's tragic to say. And certainly the Republicans, this is not, they don't view this as their constituency. They don't much care about this. They should, because these people provide an awful lot of services to them as they move throughout American society. We know there's a huge number of low-wage workers out there that are providing very essential services to people, but they just don't seem to be concerned about these people at all. I mean, this is the cold, cold heart of special interest politics. They're going to choose their contributors over minimum wage workers. It's not much more complicated than that.
And also, I mean, it all trickles up, it seems, because, you know, their contributors are the corporations that are also hiring a great percentage of the illegal immigrants, and they are not being penalized for that, and that has no resolution. And that seems to, according to some economists, stifle working wage as well.
Well, that's, you know, people want to run around and say, you know, illegal immigrants taking a job that no American wants. It may be the better picture is that this is a job that American can't afford to take because the wage is so low, and that these do undermine the wages of people who are above them.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you have this large pool of people who are now working at a poverty wage or are here illegally so they can't enforce any of their claims to wages, you really dampen wages. Now, businesses think that's great, except the taxpayers then have to pick up the health care, the education, the school lunch programs, the housing for these people because they don't have enough money to exist in American society.
So what is the solution on that one?
Increase the minimum wage and enforce the minimum wage. You have to have tough enforcement of the minimum wage so that people can't work off of the books, so that people can't pay a sub-minimum wage to people because they happen to be poor, they don't speak English, or whatever their situation is.
Mm-hmm.
But this administration has just wanted to look in the other direction because they said, well, this is benefiting our friends, the corporations, and the small business community who want to hire these people. And you're just punishing these people, and you're creating an economic disparity that is very dangerous in this country.
It's an extreme economic disparity. They're getting rid of the middle class.
Right. The middle class is getting pulled apart. A few people might be going up to the upper middle class, but more and more people seem to be losing their footing, certainly in paying for their daily necessities of health care, transportation, groceries, the utility bills, the cable bill, the telephone bill. All of these things have gone up dramatically, and yet you don't see an increase in the wages. They've basically been stagnant here for the last several years for most middle-class workers, and certainly for the poor, they just fall further and further behind. I mean, you're working at the minimum wage. It has a purchasing value at a 50-year low. So you're working for wages, that in a time that we don't even remember.
It's just horrible. And it's shifting gears a little bit. I know that you also deal with education. And I talked with Maxine Waters last week, and she was talking about trying to get some momentum and making it easier for kids to go to college. Are you part of that?
Absolutely. We're fighting very, very hard. The Republicans, they gave away the estate tax. At the same time, they cut the student aid accounts $13 billion. That's money that should have been recycled into to lower the interest rates, to make it more affordable for people to go to college. We're now seeing, for the first time in quite a while, where people who are fully qualified to go to college, meet all of the standards, are not doing so because they're afraid that they won't be able to afford it, that they won't be able to pay back their loans, and that's a tragedy. For those individuals, it's a tragedy for our economy, because every economist tells us we're going to need every worker we can get with good skills and good talents.
Right, and it's also a tragedy in terms of trying to once again compete in the global economy as some sort of manufacturing base or some sort of creative growth in terms of producing something here.
Exactly. The whole competitiveness agenda is about recognizing that a college degree and the education that comes with it is as important today as a high school degree was 25 years ago.
I really appreciate you spending a couple minutes with us, Congressman George Miller. It's great talking to you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you
very much.
You bet. Wow, man, it's like they just what the hell are poor people supposed to do? Just die?
Get poor?
They get poor, but they owe their lives to creditors. They can't. Everybody's just one.
It's a surf. They want a surf society again, like the Russian surf system.
So we are, and constitutionally, we're moving back to a monarchy. It's frightening, folks. We're going to come back and try to be not frightened. Stay with us.
A mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands. Mark Maron.
Yeah, that's me, man. That's it. Somebody got a haircut.
You just noticed that? What, are you blind?
I noticed it this morning.
Yeah?
When he came over to my house.
You could have said, hey, somebody got a haircut.
That was not the time. The time was now to say someone's got a haircut. And I got to say, you look like you got the haircut of a 12-year-old.
You know what? I like to act like a little kid.
Well, that's coincidental because our next guest has written a book called Rejuvenile. All right. Now, I got to be honest with you, dude. And I'm going to bring this up with him. I have no patience for this crap.
I know.
I have no patience for this butch wax bull crap. Doing the little twiggly in the hair and wearing shirts that look like the 50s and horn rimmed glasses.
Isn't dude like something, a 13-year-old invented? Dude?
What? Dude?
Dude?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not talking about language per se. I'm talking about a whole level of behavior and engagement in childish things, because I think it's a direct repercussion of capitalism, of marketing, of not giving adults enough options, of also infantilizing us at every turn to where literally grown people who were once, you know, in charge of wisdom, education, being barometers of culture, are in a complete, like, look at shiny thing mode. I don't care if it's a computer. I don't care if it's all damn toys.
I guess so. But maybe if they did that more, they wouldn't be sending our children to war.
What are you talking about?
I'm just saying that maybe if the old people started infantilizing themselves more, they'd think about the good things in life and enjoying life, and they wouldn't, you know, be sending people off to war, younger people.
I guess. I think it's a way that the system keeps a lot of people stupid, unfortunately. And if they had to, if they possess some of the things that children have, I mean, we'll talk to Christopher Noxon about it in a minute. I'm not, obviously, this is not a serious topic
on
some level.
You have four cats, right?
Yeah.
What are the names?
My cat's names are Monkey, Moxie, LaFonda, and Boomer.
You're kitty names.
What are you supposed to call cats?
You see what my point I'm making? Your Honor, I rest my case.
There's no point. What do you call a cat? What am I supposed to call him? Chuck?
Cat?
What am I supposed to call him?
Dave?
Like Johnson?
Our cat's name, Johnson. Right. Our cat's name is Melvin.
Okay.
That's like an adult name, and we address him as such.
I don't have
Melvin, come sit on my lap, Melvin.
No, I'm sure that Heather goes, Melvin, come here, Melly.
Well, of course, she's a chick. Chicks are, chicks do that all the time.
All right.
Are we cutting that out?
I'm not sure that we cutting that out. No, we're not cutting that out.
Why not?
Huh?
Can't we cut that out? Please?
Yeah, maybe we will. If we talk about it much more, though, we're not going to be able to cut it out. Do you understand?
Yeah.
The more it becomes a conversation about what you said about women a minute ago.
I'm just making a funny generalization that would get a big on stage with Dane Cook.
Yeah. Were you throwing the chick word around, the C word? Chicks.
Chicks.
Broads, dames, skirts.
Skirts, yeah.
Uh-huh. Sorry, I had a little tea break. I just have maybe it's because when I was younger, I wanted nothing more than to be old and wise. And it hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean I'm infantilized. I'm one of these guys. I don't like to go to see cartoon movies. I will read a comic book here and there, but I see them as grown-up comic books. Look, I don't want to burn this stuff. I want to talk to him about it. What I would like to say is I'd like to be, I wasn't the only one that said this, but the Miami 7, the doofus terror brigade that should have been in a clown car turned out to be nothing. They're nothing. They're nobody.
Yeah, what happened to that? That was a big story.
It was a big story on Friday. Everyone kept talking about it. Homegrown terrorists, Al-Qaeda, seeking out to be joined with Al-Qaeda. But the big tip-off was they were ratted out by an informer who said that he could connect them with Al-Qaeda, and they said they wanted uniforms and vehicles to create a jihadi army. Turns out none of them are really even Muslim. They're just poor, desperate people that had this big idea. But the thing I really hate about it is on Friday, there were pictures of the Sears Tower up on the internet, and there was a conversation throughout the culture about the threat of homegrown terrorism and the idea that this is somehow indicative of a step in the right direction in securing the country. These guys were idiots, and I'm not completely sure they weren't delivered to Jeb Bush to make a point during campaign time. That's the way I feel about it.
I think they were punked.
That's exactly right. They were punked. And if you live in New York, if you ever lived in New York, I think these guys were similar to those guys. There's a group of black gentlemen that show up in Union Square and in Times Square dressed in what looks like, you know, outer space outfits. If you were in a play about outer space or in a play about – if you mixed outer space with medieval outfits, and they consider themselves to be the real children of Israel.
Oh, the black Muslims?
No, they're not Muslims. They're something else. They're some sort of offshoot of Zion something. They're wackos. And I think that these guys were on their way to building their own little cell of wackoness, and that should have become clear when they asked for uniforms.
I used to walk by those guys like every week, and every time there'd be some guy up on a stage, and he'd yell at me and say, "White Devil."
Right, wearing a space outfit, right?
Yeah, I go.
Or wearing a helmet of some kind.
White Devil here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But I don't think they're Muslims. I think that these guys are offshoots of those guys, and now I'm going to have to figure out who they are, but I had no idea how to research that. Perhaps one of my listeners can fill me in.
I'm sure they could.
I had no idea how to research who the Children of Israel guys were that hang out in Union Square and in Times Square. I don't know what religion they are. They did have the Bible, and they would yell at each other, read it, and it was not the Quran. I think it was the Bible, and they said the Jews were all bunk. that it was all black people.
Bunk.
Bunk. They called it bunk. So that's a story. I'm not sure what the story is, but the real truth of the matter is the war in Afghanistan has been lost. The war in Iraq continues to be a losing endeavor. And now they put this timeline thing on the back of the Iraqi prime minister who could any that's the interesting thing, though, is if the Iraqi prime minister says, all right, we're ready for you to go. We can handle it. That they can't really do that, you know, because they're going to leave some people there. And there's no real way to trick the American public into thinking we're all out if Americans are still getting killed there. So it's still a pretty tricky endeavor to say victory is had when Iraqi can defend itself and its government can handle its own stuff. They have no intention of ever letting that happen. And people like John Murtha are saying there shouldn't be a base there. We should be out of there all in all. And if you read Frank Rich's column on Sunday, which was devastating to see how privatization and subcontractors just pillaged that country and took taxpayers for a ride, billions of dollars into projects that were half finished or done poorly in Afghanistan and Iraq. These idiots, this Republican administration, they have just completely taken they've used the government as a money laundering operation for their crap. They just ran money right into the pockets of all these no-bid contracts, into contractors that did half-assed jobs, and they made billions of dollars, and they don't give a crap about it. Talk about cut and run. Why don't we talk about that cut and run? When are they going to get electricity pumping in there every day? When are they going to get the water clean? When are they going to get the hospitals built? When are they going to go back to Afghanistan and fix the roads that were made out of crap because some contractor cut corners so he could make a fortune? Talk about that cut and run. This idea that the military should be privatized and all this stuff should be done through competitive contracting outside of the government, yet all these contractors buckle to greed and they don't have any competition and they do crappy work and they leave that with the country that we are supposed to be helping or we're supposed to be rebuilding. That's what they get, and they think they're going to change hearts and minds. Where's that cut and run? Where's the cut and run that this economic policy reveals? It's heinous. It's heinous. We will be back with baseball hats and Twister and lunchboxes and comic books. Stay with us.
He likes to get his pelican drunk. Mark Maron.
Hey, man. I might have to start all this over again if I don't find my my papers. I found them. The pelicans are drunk, and it's because of toxic algae. Is that that?
Yeah.
Is that what's going on with that?
Absolutely.
That's sad. Folks, I got to be honest with you. I don't really know what mature means. I know when people have character and authenticity, but mature, I don't know. I know that lots of people my age are desperately trying to stifle that process of aging, some with better results than others. But I also know some people in their 30s who ride scooters, wear their baseball hat backwards, talk like teenagers, and try their hardest to pull it off. Is this the new grown-up? In his book, Rejuvenile, Kickball Cupcakes and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up, Christopher Noxon makes a case for yes. Yes, this is the real grown-up. He's with us now in the studio, wearing his horn-rimmed glasses and his 50s shirt. Christopher Noxon.
It's good to be here.
It's nice to be. I'm sorry I'm busting on you.
You're in very good company, although I don't know that you are aware of the company that you're keeping. Most of the real criticism that I've gotten has come from the far right. People like Charles Dodgson and Rosemond and people who think that, you know, adults are sort of ceding their national, you know, their natural authority, sort of infantilizing themselves. And, you know, the Hollywood liberals are out here playing kickball and, you know, dealing with.
I don't think I'm coming at it from that point of view. I think mine is more psychological. I understand that argument, but my reaction to it. Let's get to what the word means first, so people understand what we're talking about. You're not talking about people trying to stay young. It's something else. This is a sort of a cultural Not really a movement, but a cultural reality. What is the definition of the word rejuvenile?
I mean, a rejuvenile is anyone who has tastes or mindsets that are sort of traditionally associated with people younger than themselves. It's adults who act or think like kids.
Right.
And we could be talking about everything from like dads who dress like skate rats, mm-hmm. or CEOs who champion the power of play in the workplace, or 20-somethings who live happily at home, or, you know, people who buy cars or clothes marketed to people half their age.
Now, I've done all those things, and I'm just trying to figure out – right now I'm trying to dig into my own self, as you told me to on the break, and to figure out why I have always had a certain amount of resentment to what I consider an affectation. It's not really an ideological thing with me, though as a kid I always aspired to be – a grown-up, but it was more of a hippie grown-up. I always wanted to be an outlaw. And that whole thing sort of has gone away with the 80s. Mm-hmm. The whole sort of like renegade, man, let's rock and roll thing sort of like got hijacked by, you know, people wearing Converse, cutting their hair, wearing horn-rimmed glasses, and being smug. So I miss the sort of passion of the rebel, which doesn't exist anymore. And now there's this other thing, which I don't think – you would probably make an argument that there's a rebelliousness to it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just don't think that traditional adulthood did us many favors. I mean, you know, the kind of company man rotting from the inside sort of 50s Ozzie and Harriet ideal is sort of what this is a reaction against. And, you know, I think that there's just a real value in that kind of childlike essence. And, you know, I'm talking about a broad range of people here. And I absolutely recognize that a lot of the people in my book, people who go to Disneyland 3, 4, 5 days a week have season passes, and people who, you know, spend all night on eBay collecting that last little adventure person. You know, these people are not great models for the kind of adults that I think any of us want to become.
But that's not childish. That's obsessive weirdness. That's pathological, what you're talking about.
Well, but the objects of their obsession are childlike, and so they sort of revolve around this kind of childlike imaginary world.
But couldn't that be considered somewhat of a mental illness as opposed to something to aspire to or be sympathetic with?
Sure. And, you know, that's what I mean in terms of a broad range. You know, you've got your sort of extreme rejuveniles and people sort of on the outer fringes of it. But for most of us, I think, you know, I have a mortgage and a minivan and 3 kids. And, you know, I try to work hard and have family relationships that are meaningful and strong. But at the same time, I'm not willing to give up those things that have always given me pleasure. And, you know, I like cupcakes. I met my wife playing kickball. I enjoy play in a way that I think most sort of standard traditional adults would have found pretty ridiculous.
Well, I guess maybe that's the primary difference, because I was never programmed that way. I personally – and also what's interesting along with this rejuvenile thing in terms of what you're talking about, the 50s and guys eating themselves out from the inside and that whole working model of what an adult was, you get guys that are dressing up in swing clothes – And running around with fedoras again as well, which isn't really rejuvenile in any way, but it's sort of retro. But that also is a trend.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a dead trend. I think probably 5 or 6 years ago we saw a lot more of that. But I think of that as rejuvenile as well, because it was sort of dress up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all – and I totally get the kind of distaste you have for that affectation and that smugness. That drives me crazy too.
I think what it disguises is a true lack of position. I think a lot of times my problem with this this sort of, you know, pseudo nerd kind of like geek chic thing, which is it's kind of bushwhacked 50s infantile, but it's not a childhood that I remember, nor that you were really old enough to remember in terms of horn rims and clothes like that. But what it represented to me was that there was this idea that we are smug, we are condescending, we are better than, we are all wise, we've been there and done that. It doesn't really imply to me a childishness. What I found it implied was an absurdity that defied having an opinion on something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly there are lots of things about this childlike essence that I think that rejuveniles respond to, mm-hmm. or sort of gravitate to, that are kind of distasteful and are better left to children. I mean, I make a real strong distinction between childish and childlike. And, you know, childish is that sort of, you know, I want candy, look, a shiny thing, you know, whatever's right in front of my face, I have to have it. And it's that sort of corporate appeal to that, you know, youngest common denominator thing that turns us all into kind of zombies. But, you know, at the same time, there is a – I think there's a real rebellious and kind of free-spirited part of that childlike essence that is, you know, quite revolutionary or at least just rebellious.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't need to be dressed. It doesn't need to have toys. I have that. You know, what you're talking about right there, you know, I can, you know, sit and watch my cat for a half an hour and cry and have all those emotions that a child has in terms of being open, like
right.
that, being childlike. I mean, that's a Zen thing.
Yep.
I mean, that's something you aspire to have that kind of naivete and all encompassing wisdom at the same time. But I don't think that necessarily requires a kickball or cupcakes.
But why shouldn't it?
No, I'm not saying you can't dress it up.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, your sort of reflective distaste, the sort of these guys all need to get a life is, I think, speaks more to your own kind of prejudice.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying they need to get a life. What I'm saying is that it doesn't imply anything other than, you're making this choice to dress up like this. And whereas I think a lot of times there's like the whole comic book culture and the sort of smarter than politics. And the one thing that's really annoyed me about this is just that you assume that these people are liberal or progressive people. And it's not necessarily true. And we can talk about some of the people you talk to. I'd like to talk about that. And I'm really not arguing with you. And there might be jealousy at the core of this. So,
you'll have to come out in the kickball field with me.
Kickball's a game I could probably handle. I think I can handle
that. You can drink a lot of beer when you play it. So,
all right.
Come on.
We're talking to Christopher Noxon. The book is Rejuvenile, Kickball Cartoons, Cupcakes, and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up. And we're going to find a medium place here. So stick around.
Now he's Hobbit number 3 in the new Lord of the Rings musical, Mark Maron.
Thanks, buddy. Our guest is Christopher Noxon. The book is Rejuvenile, Kickball Cartoons, Cupcakes, and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up. You know, I also, you know what's true about me, Christopher, is that I'm a very serious guy, I'm a very sensitive guy, and I'm a very, I found that sometimes it's the whole childish the accoutrements are a little bit emotionally evasive. And I guess what I was hoping is that when you talk about being childish, the one thing I'd like to see in that rebelliousness is that impulsive honesty. That I would love that. If guys that played this whole part were to say, "You stink because you're lying." You know, then, you know, that'd be great if they could somehow adultify that impulsive honesty that makes kids beautiful.
Yeah.
And in that, you don't see with the getup too much.
Well, I think you do. I mean, it's part and parcel. I think once you sort of tap into that kind of childlike fifth grade sort of everything is up in the air and I'm going to grab it, a lot of that comes with it.
I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more of that on stage. As I just see a lot of what you talk about in the book in terms of, you know, comic book, the sort of other world of and how it appeals to the child mind is this absurdity, something that transcends intellectual opinion per se.
Yeah, the comic book artist Art Spiegelman says it appeals to our lizard brains,
yeah.
Which I really love.
Well, let's talk about some of this other stuff. Like, I get mad that I feel like there's not enough choices for grown-ups, and I'm one of those people that I'll tell my wife, I'm like, I'm not going to see a cartoon. I'm not going to see a cartoon movie. And in your book, I'm heading towards extinction culturally on some level. But what? How does that play a part in all this, that the way we're marketed?
Well, I mean, it does concern me that the role that the sort of marketing industry plays here, because clearly, you know, that 18 to 34 sweet spot that they talk about, I think it creates a kind of cultural tractor beam that draws you in. And it's sort of – you get the sense that, like, if you're not into this stuff, you're irrelevant. It's like, you know, buy in or be forgotten. And that worries me. And
I feel
that. Yeah. I think that, you know, if once you sort of fall out of that target market, you sort of feel like, well, I better be into Pixar. I better, you know, dress like a skater. Or I don't matter anymore. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, that's particularly healthy. But I do think that sort of old age norms that said, you know, you can only be into this if you're this age are irrelevant and pretty arbitrary. I mean, if you want to dress up in a suit because you like it, if you're Paul F. Tompkins, whatever, you do that.
Yeah.
Regardless of what some age norm said. But if you want to dress like you're, you know, a sixth grader on your way to a playdate and you're 50 and that's comfortable for you, I don't see that there's any reason why somebody should say, well, grow up.
Well, they could say that's sad.
Well, they could.
I mean,
a lot of these people look really pathetic to me, too. Honestly.
Yeah.
Honestly. And, yeah. Especially, I did a chapter sort of about the adult fascination with Disney.
Uh-huh.
And I met these people called Disnoids who, get season passes and talked to a municipal magistrate out in Ohio who he and his wife have something called the Aerial Holics Anonymous. It's, uh-huh. it's a group for people who are sort of obsessive with The Little Mermaid.
Oh, boy.
And I think it's interesting and telling that he was very active in the Republican Party.
Oh, really?
There's a conservative streak among Disney obsessives that you don't find in other sort of kid-centric areas.
Well, he was sort of a fascist. I mean, the whole idea of a controlled environment that where people are having the same good time is kind of frightening.
Well, and they stripped away all the you go back to those old European folktales, and mm-hmm. those were pretty violent, thorny,
dark,
interesting things.
Yeah.
And, you see the Disney retellings of them, and they've all been cleaned up. It's the same if you go to the Disney parks. All the security guards are dressed up in themed outfits, and, mm-hmm. All the mechanization is sort of hidden behind these decorative scrims, so you never get a sense of actually what's behind the curtain.
Yeah, yeah. And also, but it seems that, like you said before, that I think everything has become toyified on some level, and that even if it doesn't seem childish, that just the fact, just the iPod, how long I fought the iPod, how long I fought getting an Apple computer. I fight these things. I tell you, I fight cartoons. I fight a lot of things because I think it, I find it embarrassing a little bit. And maybe it's because I can't pull it off and feel comfortable, but I find that really the infantilization, that the difference between embracing your inner child and being infantilized by where capitalism right now is and expanding the status quo and making everything the same, it's kind of a tough balance, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, but I really do think that the problems that we're facing today are so difficult and so they're so hard that, the kind of rote, mechanized, capital A adult approach isn't going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the current administration is a great example of that kind of, we're all going to be grown-ups about this problem. And, I mean, Al Gore wrote a chapter in one of his books about sort of the power of play and about sort of using play as a way to kind of get outside yourself and come up with new ideas and bring a real creativity to things.
Yeah, I think that what was I really thinking about this? My fear with what you just said is that may all be well and good, and play is good. But I think that a lot of what you're saying is like, okay, we got real problems. Why don't we have a conversation about how to deal with those problems? Why? Look at my skateboard. You see, I think that there is some of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that part of this whole disposition is evading a cultural conversation about change. Yet you say in your book that there is a historical precedent that this may be a precipice of change.
Yeah, I mean, I trace it back to around 1900, where I think our most sort of pervasive ideas about adulthood and childhood were sort of born. You know, everything from Peter Pan and the first amusement parks to, the mass marketing of candy and children's clothes. And I mean, it was really then that we kind of decided what an adult was and what a kid was.
Right.
And those barriers became very strict. And, I think it was the 60s and the Flower Children, don't forget they were called children, that sort of threw all those things up into the air.
Yeah. And that's what, oddly, the Flower Children is probably what real adults acting like children looks like.
Yeah.
And it had nothing, what they were wearing and what they were doing had no semblance of a fashion per se, like kids. But the way they were behaving and engaging in the world was very childlike and very vulnerable and weird. And I don't see a lot of vulnerability in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, again, broad range. There were people that I met in Kansas City who have this, something called the TAG Institute. And, it's everything from 9-year-olds to 60-year-old women to, 30-something folks.
Playing tag.
And I love those people. They were so much fun. And they did it out of such a spirit of just kind of inclusiveness and joy.
Well, that's fun. Community activity is fun.
Yeah.
I guess I'm really – I don't take –
issue with a lot of the ideas of being childlike and learning how to have those feelings again, because I think it's important, and it's a lot of that stuff has been damped down by one thing or another, by thinking of who we should be, what is an adult, or by our parents before us. I guess it's just the fashion of it and how that distracts people sometimes I have a problem with.
Yeah.
Though I've worn Converses when I was in my 20s. I did for a long time. I got very committed to them. And I had the butch wax haircut, and I had horn rims. I've been through this stuff. I think that one of my problems is like I'm trying to figure out, all right, so now I'm not sure I can pull that stuff off. So how do I grow up with a little dignity?
Yeah. I mean, I take it to the therapist, my friend.
Go, you got no answers for me. Come on, Christopher. You got no answers for me. I'm putting you on the spot for some answers. Now, but didn't you meet any, like, you had a statistic in here that I found kind of disturbing about, you know, how old some people are that are still living at home, that there's a trend. Was that in your book, or was that somewhere else I read that? That it's not unusual for people between 20 and 35 to be living with their phones?
Yeah, I think 37% of people in that age group still live with their mom and dad.
But that's not a good thing.
I think it is. And I'll tell you why. I mean, you know, it is too easy to and you know, your conservative friends will hop on the bandwagon about how, you know, this generation of kids have been, you know, grown up having their self-esteem stoked, and you know, they're unable to sort of face the hard realities of the real world, and so they want all their laundry done, and so they're, you know, home mooching off their parents. But the, you know, the reality is that around the world and through history, and that, you know, parents have not had this kind of production model of parenting that we now are sort of getting over. The idea that, you know, when you're 18, you're out the door is really kind of a remnant of the Industrial Revolution. It's an idea that, like, you create a little worker bee, you send them out into the world, and you're done. And I think it's actually, when you go out and talk to these kids and to their parents, you actually discover that they're getting along better. They're knowing each other in ways as adults that I think parents and kids of the 60s and 70s didn't.
I think disappointment can be very bonding. And I don't know why that, you know, you keep aligning me with the right. I mean, my feeling is like, if I were living with my parents, now maybe this is a personal issue again, at 30, I would shoot myself, because it would be just horrendous. Right? The thought of living with my parents at that age would just be horrifying. And maybe that's out of fear, because I would have felt like I failed or not. But I'll give you 22. Okay, 18, fine. Maybe that is a remnant of the Industrial Revolution. But at 22, you might want to think about moving in.
You know, I left my home when I was 17 and never looked back.
You feel better, right?
I do. Yeah, I couldn't have lived with my folks one more day.
Yeah.
You know, I met a lot of people who have relationships with their parents that I really admired. And, like, you know, I was probably in my 30s when I finally kind of realized that my parents were pretty much just like me. They were adults. They were trying to figure stuff out.
Right, yeah.
And you don't get that realization until you're out of your house for, you know, 10, 15 years. You have kids yourself, and you're like, wait a minute, they had all the same kind of problems that I did.
Right.
And, you know, the kids who are living with their parents as adults, usually paying rent, usually having sort of forging new adult relationships, are getting that earlier. And I think it helps.
Yeah.
You know, they're able to actually go through that apprenticeship situation, date, you know, as many people as they need to before they settle down. The idea that we have to, like, take these predetermined sets of obligations at certain points in our life is really kind of crazy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, that's interesting that is a remnant of something that is not here, and it was set, you know, by an industrial model that doesn't apply anymore. Is what you're saying.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's interesting. But it's just, it gets a little dicey when you're 30 and you want to have sex with your girlfriend, and you're like, shh, come on, be quiet. You know, and you're moving, like, action figures off of the bed. I think that's a little sad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, broad range of people. And
I'll tell you, Christopher, it turns out to be a very compelling, topic. And I know that you cover all sides of it in here in terms of what we talked about. And believe me, I have no alignment with the right. It's all out of resentment of people that seem to be having a better time than me and my parents. Okay. I appreciate the conversation, and I'm looking forward to finishing the book.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Rejuvenile, Kickball, Cartoons, Cupcakes, and the Reinvention of the American Grown-Up. Thank you for being here, Christopher Noxon. We will be back in a second with some funny.
now he blames his older brothers for making him gay, Marc Maron.
I don't have an older brother, Mr. Younger Brother Guy.
Older sisters for making them gay, Marc Maron.
I don't have any older sisters. I'm the oldest and the only one. My brother is younger than me. Christopher Noxon, our previous guest, Rejuveniles, the book, is going to be reading at Skylight Books in Los Feliz on Vermont. That's July 9th. July. It's going to be on the Colbert Report later this week, maybe Thursday or Friday. And you can go to rejuvenile.com, which I'll put up on my website by the time you hear this coming out of your speaker. I think it all goes back to me. Like, I remember one time when I was in college, my father turned me on to Buddy Holly and to a lot of the oldies. And I'm sitting at a dinner table with some art geeks, you went to college. You were one of them. You went to art school. And I was talking about Buddy Holly in my naive sophomore in college way. And I said, no one's going to be as good as Buddy Holly. And some guy wearing horn-rim glasses, oddly looking a bit like Buddy Holly, looked at me and said, "You're a fascist." And I still haven't quite figured out what the hell it meant, but the arrogance and condescension of the way he said it made me resent that kind of geek-chic, holier-than-thou condescension tone of people like that, man. I like people wear their emotions on their sleeves, not dress like seven-year-olds to try to imply that they have a childish capacity to be open and emoting.
Emotions on their sleeves?
Yeah, I like it.
I don't know what you mean by that. I don't know anybody who does that except, like, killers and...
What are you talking about? I mean, I don't...
Killers and abusive people.
I don't like people that
out of control people.
Are cryptic. Oh, come on. Stop it. You wear your heart on your sleeve. Is that a better way to put it?
Okay. That's a little better, I guess.
That's what I meant to say. But it's just like, I don't buy it. I don't buy all this, butch wax kind of horn rim crap. It doesn't imply anything other than you are desperately trying to be authentic in a way that by using... old models. I don't know. It irritates me, but I like the book, and he talks about all this. But
people could still be in a rockabilly band, dressed like that.
Whatever. It's still avoiding who you are. I believe that.
If they're rockabilly, rockabillers, maybe that's who they are.
I understand that. No, come on, Jim. I mean, come on.
Do you have a picture of your dad? I have a picture of my dad dressed in his brother's dressed as Little Lord Fauntleroy.
In his brother's dress?
Dressed as. You know how they used to dress kids up in the 20s?
Yeah. In dresses.
You didn't know if they were girls or boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the point is?
I don't know. That just always disturbed me.
It is disturbing. I just can't be cool in that way. I can't be cool I'm dressed like a kid from the 50s. I can't be cool in the way that I'm wearing horn-rimmed glasses and I got a slingshot in my back pocket and I'm talking about...
You mean you've never gone on stage with
last night's Simpsons.
With your skateboard?
No, that's Dimitri Martin. He's walking around with a skateboard, an easel, a guitar, wearing a tie with an emo boy haircut. And I'm like, dude, how about just a few jokes? How about just a piece of notebook paper? Anyways, incredibly popular, too. I mean, it's because the kids like him. Look at me. I'm like angry old guy.
So everybody loves Steve Martin. Steve Wright, too.
I'm angry old guy. The only way that I'll be able to transcend is if, like, I become so angry and peculiar that I'm a caricature. That is the only shot I have is, like, that guy's weird, man. He was, like, out there, dude. That's the only shot I have at appealing to the market that he's talking about is if I become so freaky, I transcend a fashion.
You need to be a cartoon.
I'm on my way. That's what I mean. That cartoon.
Well, Buster Keaton was a brilliant comic, and he was a cartoon. Yeah. Everything he did in those movies was like you were watching a cartoon before cartoons did it.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know why I brought that point up. Go ahead.
No, it was a nice point. I appreciate it. Let's do a short order of news here so you're not uninformed or ill-advised or whatever the hell it is. President Bush sharply condemned the disclosure of a program to secretly monitor the financial transactions of suspected terrorists. Said the president, quote, "If we have to take away every bit of privacy an American has in order to protect your right to privacy, the New York Times needs to support that." End quote. At least 50,000 Iraqis have died violently since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion, 20,000 higher than previously acknowledged by the Bush administration. However, the Bush administration refused to acknowledge the corpses and insists on calling them freedom stiffs. People should not use mobile phones outdoors during thunderstorms because of the risk of being struck by lightning, doctors said Friday. Health experts fear this report will lead to thousands of cell phone users standing in thunderstorms calling their friends to tell them they're using their cell phones in thunderstorms. Holding a metal object when struck by lightning increases the odds of a fatal injury, and the danger is compounded if you're calling someone to tell them how well your golf game is going. All right. That's the short order news for today. Russ Feingold, hero. Here's who's on the show tomorrow. I haven't talked to Feingold in a while, man. I used to talk to him a lot on Sedition. There was a period there where we talked to him like two or three times. And just great. He was just great on Meet the Press. Look, Jonathan Alter from Newsweek is going to tell us how to beat the cut and run frame tomorrow. Okay, so bring your notebooks. Andrea J. Dew. Co-author, Insurgents, Terrorists, and Militias, The Warriors of Contemporary Combat. This is an amazing book. It's a smart book, and it breaks down what we're up against in terms of how warfare operates in relation to how it used to operate during the Cold War and going back to the original design of modern warfare. Michael Walker, also author of Laurel Canyon, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Legendary Neighborhood. That should be great. You know what I mean? Zappa, The Byrds, Manson.
Yeah, man.
Good stuff.
Tate.
Who? Tate, yeah.
Sharon Tate.
Sure, sure.
Mr. Tate on Bewitched.
Uh-huh, yeah, he's there. Darren! Jim.
Yeah, what? I'm here.
Have a good night, and cute Converse shoes.
Nice, man. That's
a cute haircut. What are you, seven? Where's your swing shot?
Stylish.
Good night, sheeple. I don't know, Wally.